I'm guessing that is relevant to the ambulatory setting.
Somebody define what that means.
So someone does a neck manipulation and they get a carotid dissection.
Ooh.
Where, in what environment would there be a neck manipulation?
Osteopathy, chiropractors.
So maybe physical therapy, probably not. Not probably not, but...
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
Does this scope include chiropractic?
Right.
I think
yes.
It does.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I think the concern originally was about high-velocity manipulations, which were associated with neurologic problems.
That's correct. And as the steering committee reviews this one in the future, the osteopathic and chiropractic groups do have letters of comment in place already for us.
They're conflicted.
Yes.
Okay, so relevant to our environment, yes. Discrete, auditable, and clearly defined? I would say yes.
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 Yeah.
Meets the criteria? I would say yes.
Yep.
Any modifications from anyone?
No, I don't have any.
And entirely preventable or largely preventable? I mean, that's where the conflict will be. I think the physical therapy world would say you shouldn't be doing this. But I guess there's controversy.
It is controversial, but I would also agree that they shouldn't be doing them.
Should we go with entirely preventable?
Well, would that apply then to chiropractors?
I mean, you're basically saying any work that a chiropractor did that ended with a bad result would be... entirely preventable, which basically
right.
would be destroying the entire profession of chiropractic.
If it resulted in death or serious disability, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's just a question of, I guess, and I just don't know the answer, but the question of, medical doctors, we do things that have, are usually helpful, but sometimes have bad unintended consequences, and I don't know if this would sort of fall under the same rubric about basically too bad but not really preventable in the scope of overall harm to benefit, or if this really is something kind of basically a never event or an almost never event.
Well, maybe we should defer to the steering group on this because they'll have the information from the various societies, et cetera, so they can sort of mull over the entirely versus largely question.
That makes sense.
Agree.
Okay. Next one, artificial insemination with the wrong donor sperm or wrong egg. These are definitely happening in...
Oh, definitely applicable in an IVF, practice setting.
Yeah. I would say it is relevant to our setting. Does everyone agree?
Agree.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Discrete, auditable, clearly defined... Say yes.
Clearly defined.
Meets the definition, serious, unambiguous, and preventable. I would say it's pretty serious, yes. Any modifications? Okay. And entirely preventable?
Yes.
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 Okay. Moving along quickly here, hopefully. Death or serious disability associated with an electric shock. And that excludes planned treatments such as aversion, et cetera. We probably want to change it to healthcare setting if we think it's applicable to us.
I think it's applicable. I think we should change it to setting.
Okay.
I agree.
Okay. And then criteria 2, discrete, audible, clearly defined, I'd say... Yes, and meets the definitional criteria, say yes. And then the modifications, one suggestion was remove elective cardioversion and replace with any and unintended electric shock.
But I thought that was an exclusion. We were excluding elective cardioversion.
Yeah, I think that's an error. That should be...
It sounds like they're removing the exclusion and defining it as unintended electric shock, so that it...
In the main definition.
Main definition.
Medically intended electric shocks.
Right.
I mean, that would make sense to me to put that in the main definition, that it's any unintended electric shock.
Yep.
I have a question. This is more of like the preventability, which is, I'm not saying we shouldn't do this, but just maybe part of the context, is the extent to which in private offices electrical equipment is covered under kind of the same maintenance, upkeep, and certification requirements as might be required in a healthcare facility. And it's just more the context about how it's implemented and recommendations for improvement.
Well, I think if it's in their practice, though, they are responsible for it, even if it's not sort of, you know, under Joint Commission guidelines or things like that.
Yeah. No, I agree it should be included. I'm just wondering if it's a minor point.
The other modification was consider combining the burn SRE with the shock SRE, which, again, we can defer to the main steering group, but that could be reasonable, actually.
Yeah, I think that...
Shock leads to a burn, which where do you put it kind of thing. So it might that might be a reasonable thing to combine.
I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then entirely preventable or largely preventable?
Entirely preventable. Well,
I'd say largely preventable.
Because yeah, you may have a piece of equipment that is faulty and you don't know it.
Yeah. Exactly.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay, so largely preventable. Okay, next one is the burn one. So associated with a burn incurred from any source while being cared for in a healthcare facility. So we've already talked about maybe just combining those two together. But I think everything else would be the same in terms of our discussion thus far.
I would argue against combining them. But, again, I think you're going to – I think they could be separate. They don't always – I don't think electrical shocks always lead to burns. And
well, I think they said you would do – well, the recommended language was – death or disability as a complication of medical care associated with electrical, chemical, or thermal injury while being cared for in a healthcare facility. So it's not that the shock has to lead to the burn, but they're just sort of lumping them all together.
That's okay.
Okay with me.
Okay.
Really quickly, did we jump past the line designated for oxygen or other gas?
Oh, sorry, I did. Sorry. Well, it was good, actually. But, where am I? Yeah. I did, sorry. So, anyway, I think we were done with the burn one anyway. So let's go back to the oxygen one. Any incident in which a line designated for oxygen or other gas to be delivered to a patient contains the wrong gas or is contaminated by toxic substances?
Yes, it's applicable based on our previous discussions about
procedures and other things.
What about a case where there's where there's no gas flowing through the line?
Ooh.
I can't say we've had any experience with that, but we've had some experience with that.
I would include that.
Yeah, we've had some experience with
oxygen,
that,
oxygen, and they're getting nothing.
Oxygen canisters, for example.
Or the line was fixed by a contractor and then or the, it was shut off by a contractor and never restarted, that kind of thing.
Hypothetically, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so that would be a good modification. So wrong gas or is contaminated or is
absent.
Gas not being delivered.
Or yeah. Gas is not delivered.
Now, in this one, if we're going to say gas not delivered, it would have to be, you know, serious injury or death associated with rather than just any time it happens.
That's true.
Yes.
Once the patient starts squirming around, you realize no anesthesia.
So I'm not sure why they didn't have why that higher level of severity wasn't included in the original definition.
Well, I think it's sort of like the wrong side surgery one, where the disability is not there either, where they feel like, you know, this is
should never happen. Yeah,
enough that it should never happen, regardless.
Yeah.
That might be a little restrictive here to say, you know, if you're talking like just a nasal cannula line and then some rolls the cart over it and the wheel gets stuck on the line and so it's
not
for a minute, you know, so it probably needs a little more something happening to the patient.
I agree.
Your point.
So does that mean that the gas not being delivered needs to be kind of a separated out type of thing, because that one would have serious disability or death associated with it?
Well, the other problem here is that, you know, generally you may not even know that the wrong gas is being delivered unless the patient has a bad outcome. So it may just lead to problems with the actual reporting. But it may be good to, you know, not require the patient die for it to be reported either, or seriously disabled, because that's too high a bar.
Well, while we're mulling that over, the other recommended addition was, while being cared for in a healthcare facility, was for the was recommended, though, for our setting, it might have to be while cared for in setting again, as opposed to facility. I'm still thinking about, Saul, your example here, and whether we would want to split that out into something separate.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm open-minded about whether it be a separate item or not. I mean, I think it makes sense to keep the whole gas thing all in one place.
Yeah.
Maybe we could add a language, some language at the end of the existing one, which says, or an event where death or serious injury results from failure,
failure of delivery.
Yeah, or something like that, or obstructed or disconnected line, or something like that. Or maybe it's better just to focus on the lack of the gas being flowed. I don't know.
Okay. I think probably that's the best thing, is to keep it as is, but then add in another phrase, you know, or death, serious disability associated with, you know, I would probably just say, you know, lack of gas delivery or some wording like that, because, you know, we don't necessarily want to get into the causes of was it obstructed, was it turned off by the, you know, construction person, whatever.
Right.
But I think if there's death or serious disability from the gas not flowing, that would be worth knowing.
Good.
Okay. And so those are the modifications to this one. Is the event entirely preventable or largely preventable?
Largely.
Largely.
Agree.
Agree.
Okay.
I'll go with the crowd.
I was leaning towards entirely, but I mean, the wrong gas and contamination, one would think we could prevent, and gas not being delivered.
I don't know about the contamination. I mean, you know, we have tanks that are filled, you know, and I don't, you know, I presume that the company's putting the right gas in the tank.
Yeah.
And how do you know? It's not like everybody's testing it.
Yeah.
Presumably is some quality check that tests it.
There should be.
Or you have... You know, you could obtain it from the company who's doing it, what their quality standards are for.
Oh, yeah, some kind of a documentation.
Right.
It's entirely preventable if you bring it back to the supplier, but maybe not if you leave it at the level of the physician.
Mm-hmm.
Which probably at the level of the physician for this.
Yeah.
Just like we talked about with the contaminated drugs, so it's probably the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Be consistent, yeah.
Okay, so then we did the burn one.
Oh, wait, can we go back? Did we add the while being cared for in a healthcare setting?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, so the only question about that is we definitely had an incident in sort of on transport home where the gas wasn't flowing. So would that be, you know, in the healthcare setting?
That was in the ambulance?
In the ambulance, yes.
Office. It's really the ambulance's issue,
right? Yeah, but I guess EMS is still considered a healthcare setting.
But it's not a physician's office, per se.
That's true.
All right, we'll just leave it with healthcare setting, and that's fine as a starting point. Okay, so D, fall. Patient death or serious disability associated with a fall while being cared for in a healthcare setting, again. So applies to our setting?
Yes.
Yes. Discrete, auditable, and clearly defined? Yes. Meets the criteria?
Yes.
Well, this is a hard one.
Well, this is the one of the main reasons for the largely preventable versus entirely preventable with falls.
Why do you think it's a hard one? It seems sort of obvious and straightforward to me.
Well, most of our people are falling on the way into clinic or before they've seen a provider.
So I don't think that probably is in our purview, but a patient who falls off an exam table or falls in the waiting room?
That I agree with. We have, you know, children who, you know, who get broken things. They're not exactly falling. They're usually jumping.
Yeah.
Climbing, et cetera.
Climbing and jumping.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of kind of the unstable gait geriatric patient.
I agree.
Right. Or when they're walking from the waiting room to, and whether or not that can really be, you know, blamed on the physician. I'm not sure, which I think is different from the inpatient setting in which there should be greater monitoring of patients at fall risk. It's a little harder to do in the outpatient setting.
We also
just
have
to
a lot
point
of
out, you just made an interesting connection or statement about blame. And we haven't really talked about that here, but I think it is interesting. We're not talking about blame. We're talking about should these events be reported to get some kind of investigation.
And also, there are ways to potentially screen, especially older patients, you know, and maybe they don't walk unassisted, or I don't know. I mean, there's things that potentially could be done.
Where the office doesn't have, you know, the right assistance, you know, facilities or whatever. So
handrails, those kinds of things.
Or even a wheelchair. I think that this is a largely preventable.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I dissent. I mean, we have a lot of patients who decline assistance. And what do you do in an ambulatory setting? It's not like an inpatient setting where you can say you must sit in the wheelchair until they get you to the door.
Are you saying it's not applicable?
I'm saying it's applicable, but I think the preventability is a big issue.
Mm. So you're saying maybe it's less than largely preventable?
Yes.
I mean, I think it's interesting. So we're not looking at blame necessarily, but looking at reportability and presumably investigation.
Yeah.
Maybe the threshold should be different in an ambulatory setting. Not that it's not serious, not that it's not important, but the threshold of it is a little bit different. So we may want to think about language.
Or do we limit it to
certain kinds
waiting,
of falls?
You know, sort of limit it to those areas as opposed to, you know, the parking lot right in front and the, you know, walking in and that sort of thing. So, like, kind of when they're in the
care of the
clinical team.
Within
yeah.
the actual office space itself, yeah.
Right.
It's reasonable.
I mean, I'll say I've kind of been persuaded to include this as opposed to not, because I think that even, it depends how well you define or how risk largely preventable is or not. But, you know, I think probably there are a lot of ways to prevent falls just by closer monitoring of patients who do have gait instability, even if you can't prevent 100%. You can probably prevent, you know, a fair number of them.
So maybe, though, we say something instead of just while being cared for in the healthcare setting, say something, you know, while under the direct care of healthcare providers or something like that. To
healthcare team.
Yeah, I would say healthcare team.
Only when the provider is with them, because then if the nurse is with them or the
team, right, sorry, so the healthcare team, even the medical assistant or whoever it might be.
Yep,
right.
I don't know, I think that might be a little, I think it's too ambiguous, because then if you say that they get checked into the triage nurse and the nurse says, okay, walk down to that office over there and, you know, take a seat, and then are they in the healthcare setting when they're walking the hall or not, or under the care of the healthcare team?
Should we have, I feel like we still should have some responsibility to ensure that the patient doesn't fall in that.
I absolutely agree. That's why I think the healthcare team might be a little too ambiguous. I think maybe if you say, like, actually within the physical confines of the office, which distinguishes from the parking lot where you can't reasonably control.
Pat Michael Steinman speaking?
Yes.
Right, because I think, I mean, you probably have the strongest impact in this beyond, you know, falling off an exam table or something like that, or something sort of truly unsafe, but your geriatric patient population presents factors that you might identify that the rest of us wouldn't necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think once you walk in the door of the office and then someone in your office sets eyes on you, from that point forward, there should probably be some mechanism of identifying and remediating fall risk for people who clearly have unstable gait.
I would support that.
At the time, but.
So I think we'll keep it and we'll say it's largely preventable. And do we want to then just what modification language we want to do about sort of we decided we don't want healthcare team. Do we want to say, you know, while in the care of I don't know. I'm blanking on the language. I mean, it says right now while being cared for in a healthcare facility, which we said while being cared for in a healthcare setting. Maybe that's fine because, you know, you're not really being cared for when you're in the parking lot.
Yeah, maybe that could be implementation guidance.
Yeah, and in the implementation guidance, we make it clear. Well, as clear as mud. Okay. So I'm looking at the time. I know we still have a few more of the existing SREs, but I also want to give people a few minutes to take a bathroom break and maybe grab some lunch to eat on the rest of the call. So, Lindsay, what if we took a short break right now?
Yeah, that's fine. I'm 5 or 10 minutes. We're in there.
Let's do a 10-minute break. So
okay.
My clock says 12:26. I don't know what everyone else's says, or 12:27. So why don't we do a 10-minute break? We'll reconvene around 12:37.
Should we disconnect and call back in?
Just leave the line open. That's the simplest, easiest.
Okay.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, this is Tejal again. By my clock, it's 10 minutes. Lindsay, do you think we need to do a roll call, or should we just start and... Hello?
Okay.
Hello.
Liz back.
Hi.
Okay, let's just get started. I'm sure people will filter back.
It's amazing what you can get done in 5-10 minutes.
I know. Sorry it's a short break, but I would love to get through all of these. Okay, so we are on letter E, though Lindsay's taking notes, so I should make sure she's back. Lindsay, are you back? Or is anyone from NQF on the line? I know they're recording as well, so you know what? We'll just keep going because they are recording this. Okay, so we are on letter E, patient death or serious disability associated with the use of restraints or bed rails while being cared for in a healthcare facility. So relevant to our setting?
In a limited way, it probably is.
Yeah, the whole issue of bed rails, unless you're in like an ambulatory surgery center, I don't know many offices have bed rails.
I'm thinking more restraints, and particularly around pediatrics and restraining them for procedures, immunizations. Would that fall into this?
And sometimes in my clinic, I know people came in on stretchers and such from nursing homes and so on, so they did have bed rails on the stretchers. So anyway, so probably relevant.
Probably relevant, and we can put caveats around its relevance in the ambulatory setting.
Sorry, so while being cared for in a healthcare setting, you mean?
Right, yes.
Okay. Okay, so...
I'll just offer a quick voice of dissent. I'm not sure it really captures what we're trying to get at, which is the original intent in the inpatient setting. Like, this is really an issue in the outpatient setting. The patient might be coming in a gurney, but it really seems to be dealing with the important inpatient issue about patients getting trapped in bed rails.
Similar to another, maybe we should go through it, but put a note to the steering committee to say, you know, depending on the focus, the sort of intent of this, it may not be relevant.
Yeah, I mean, we have oncology patients who receive their treatment in chairs and others in more traditional beds, but, you know, again, it's a scope issue, I think.
I mean, I would be okay with saying this one's not applicable to us just because, kind of, Mike, to your point, I mean, in the ambulatory setting, this is probably such a non-issue compared to other things.
It could potentially occur with restraint of pediatric or elderly patients that are not normally able to comply with imaging studies.
Right.
That would be probably out of scope in terms of the physician office for this CAP.
Well, it does say healthcare facility.
True, but for this particular TAP, we just are focusing on physician offices.
Okay.
So in the physician office, I'm not guessing this is really that relevant.
But by definition, if it's a hospital outpatient department JCO accredited, then it, you know, it's more likely to apply with the example you gave, because we have the same thing. They're brought over in a hospital bed. But for the most part, I agree, it doesn't apply.
Well, I think Peter, when he initially introduced it, said really think about it as a standalone offices as opposed to hospital-based offices. We could go either way. I mean, we could definitely talk it through, but put in that caveat that, you know, if we're really focusing on standalone practices, this may not be relevant. So if we do continue to do it, is it discrete, auditable, and clearly defined?
Yes.
Meets the definition of serious, unambiguous, and preventable or largely preventable?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
Any modifications that anyone would suggest? The only modification here is suggesting putting it in a different category instead of being under environmental, to put it under care management. But anything else that people would recommend besides also what we talked about in terms of clarifying if it's really relevant to us?
No, I don't have anything.
No.
Okay. And then would this one be largely preventable?
Yep.
Anyone disagree with that?
Nope.
No,
I guess not.
Okay. So moving on to the criminal events. Letter A, any instance of care provided by or provided by someone impersonating a physician, nurse, pharmacist. So could be relevant.
Agree.
Yes.
Yes.
Discrete, auditable, and clearly defined.
I need to back up for a minute.
Uh-huh.
We have a lot of medical assistants in offices who may not be licensed and often are referred to as nurse, the nurse.
Yes.
Mm.
So that could be a problem.
That's interesting.
That happens a lot. And they're certified. They are not licensed. And
well,
some aren't even that.
Some are just trained on the job.
So, you know, they are not necessarily impersonating and saying that they're a nurse.
Mm. Yeah, but they don't deny that they're not.
That's right.
Well, hopefully they're not ordering care.
Sometimes they are.
You know, they call in prescriptions. They give shots. They put on casts. They.
But under
this is Peter. Similarly, of
provider.
Similarly, we've had exposure to practices where the nurse practitioners or the PAs get called doctor, and they similarly don't dissuade that attribution either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some nurse practitioners are doctors, and there's no law that prohibits them from being identified as such, but I think most say, you know, I'm a nurse practitioner. I was the president of the largest nurse practitioner organization. We have conversations around this all the time. And, you know, there may be the rogue out there who's trying to be, you know, confused with a physician, but that hasn't been our experience. It's a big problem.
I mean, to me, this... Excuse me.
But it does bring up, you know, fraud, basically.
Right. Well, would it be appropriate to... Is it appropriate to say that, you know, that, and I don't know if we're making recommendations, but that all care providers must be recognized? Because I know a lot of hospitals now, they distinctly, if you're an RN, you have this big RN
mm-hmm.
sign under your name tag. So they can distinguish who's a physician, who's not a physician, who's an RN, who's not an RN.
This event, to me, was going after the rogue. You know, Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, but this one was really going after those rogue people who, you know, are pretending to be people they're not, and not, you know, an MA in a practice who a
right.
patient calls nurse.
No, exactly. Exactly. It's trying to...
Well, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure that was clearly understood.
Maybe in the implementation guidance, that should just be clarified. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise you're going to rope in every medical student who, you know, fails to correct the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I think in the implementation guidance, it can just be clarified what the intent is here. So is it discrete, auditable, and clearly defined? Once we put that in the implementation guidance?
Yes.
Yep.
And then meets the criteria? Any modifications? One suggestion here is to combine all the criminal SREs into one event, and they recommend some wording that folks could read, which, you know, might be reasonable just because these are so rare that instead of having, you know, four SREs related to criminal events, maybe it makes sense to just have one. But I'll let the steering committee decide that.
I would argue against it. I think assault on healthcare workers, I just reviewed this not too long ago. I mean, it's not an insignificant problem. But that's just my 2 cents worth.
It may be an underreported problem then, but I think the volumes of reporting those are pretty low, but I think I agree that it's probably happening. It's just not getting reported.
Right.
So anyway, we'll let the steering group figure that out. But any other modifications to this specific one about impersonation?
Just one thing about the preventability. Some of it is maybe a little off, not super relevant. In particular, I'm looking at number 3, identification badges. I don't know if that really wants to be mandated for all sort of small solo outpatient practices.
Yeah, because a lot of the smaller ones, they just have a little name tag sort of thing that just has their name on it.
Yeah, or even no name tag. Hi, I'm Dr. So-and-so. I'm the only one who works here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah.
In a small practice, you're right, that may not be relevant.
Related to that, there was a law, I don't know if it passed in Pennsylvania or not, but the State Medical Association was very much involved with this, with, I think it was color-coding badges of specific people. I don't know whether it passed or not.
So to your point, though, we can recommend modification of some of the language in the preventability section.
It does sound a little weird if you're the only one there to wear an ID badge, but I don't think it's wrong. And I,
yeah,
you know, I mean, even if you're a solo practice, you probably have other people in your office, whether it be a medical assistant or a secretary or whatever, and for people to...
I think they often will have a little placard in front of where they're sitting, though, as opposed to wearing a badge.
For patients to clearly know whom they're interacting with, I think is valuable.
I agree. I think it's very valuable, even in a small office. Elderly people can get confused. People can forget names.
Agree.
You know, who was it that you spoke to? Who was it that did this? You know, I think patients deserve to know.
I agree.
And we can't presume they do.
Yep, agree.
Okay, well, we can leave the language in preventability then. It's just a suggested practice anyway.
Okay.
Okay, and then should these be entirely preventable or largely preventable?
I would say largely preventable. I mean, I've been involved in issues where you're trying to verify that, you know, this physician is credentialed and completed medical school, and, you know, sometimes they're very, very good at covering that stuff up.
Yeah.
I think you're right. If they have criminal intent, it's, you know, they can be good at it.
Right.
Again, should it be largely or completely preventable? And I mean, ideally, it should be completely preventable.
Well, and that gets to the definition of, you know, largely means maybe right now it's not, but as technology and other things evolve, we might get to the point where, you know, when we all have retina scans, who knows? But, you know, then it might be entirely, but at least right now, I think we probably have to say largely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, the next one is abduction of a patient of any age.
Yes.
I think that's definitely relevant.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Happens.
Comment how it happened. It just seems like this is analogous to the infant thing, which we said was not
right.
So I'm curious how people are saying this.
Well, I think giving a baby to the wrong person is a little different from someone coming into the clinic and taking a baby, for example.
Or a child.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
Or a child.
Or an impaired adult. A senior.
Right. Right.
Yep. I understand.
Okay. So relevant to our environment, yes. Is it discrete, auditable, and clearly defined?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In the criminal code, yes.
And then serious, unambiguous, and preventable or largely preventable?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Any modifications? The modifications listed here, again, are just to combine with the other ones, which, again, the steering group can think about. But anything else in terms of modifying this one?
No, I don't have anything.
Okay. Okay. So, and then largely preventable?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
Sexual assault on a patient within or on the grounds of a healthcare facility? We want to change it to setting again. And do we want to have grounds of a healthcare setting? I mean, again, the parking lot outside the practice kind of thing?
Yeah, I would say if we can limit it to within the office setting.
I think so.
If they walk down the hall to the outpatient radiology center and they're either abducted or assaulted, is that something that you really have any control over?
I think within the office setting it makes sense.
Yeah. Peter is on, or anyone from NGRF, can you give the history of why it included grounds?
Well, it was, I think, you know, for those times when patients are outside the actual facility.
Like in a psychiatric facility where they might have lawns and other things where people take walks and stuff. I can think of one place in Massachusetts like that. That would be relevant.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
That's not really that's not a physician office per se, is it?
No, but that's where this came from.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see... I have problems with anything outside the confines of the office itself.
Yeah, for an ambulatory.
I mean, if you're working in an inner city area, you know, with underserved people, you can't be responsible for the sidewalk outside the office.
Right. I think we'll limit this one to, we can limit this one, the next one, et cetera. We'll use the same language, but say within the office setting.
Okay.
Discrete, auditable, and clearly defined, yes, meets the criteria. I would say yes, unless anyone disagrees.
Okay.
And the summary of suggested modifications. So we've already taken care of number one, which is the grounds thing. And number two, we've already talked about. Anybody else have any modifications to this one?
No.
Okay. And the last one is D. Death or significant injury of a patient or staff member resulting from physical assault, and again, we would change that language as we've talked about in the office setting. So relevant to our environment.
Yes.
That way.
Yes.
Discrete, audible, clearly defined, yes. Criteria, yes. Any other modifications from anyone?
No.
Nope.
And then entirely preventable or largely preventable? I would say largely preventable.
Largely.
Yeah, I would say largely.
Okay. So that's it for the existing. Yay. So we have about an hour to go through the new ones.
And if we could just take a moment to see if anyone on the public lines has any comment. Operator?
Yes, ma'am.
If we could check with anyone on the public lines to see if they have any questions or comments.
Public lines are open.
This is Rita Gallagher from the American Nurses Association. Following on to Dr. Ann Good's earlier comments regarding applicability, I would really respectfully request that the panel begin to utilize more inclusive language as appropriate throughout its deliberations, which would be reflective of clinicians, practitioners, healthcare professionals, as opposed to only referencing physicians or doctors. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Kay Jewell.
Okay.
And I would have two comments. One is about the identification of the, I guess it was the criminal identification of people who were falsifying who they were. It's not just that the patients don't remember, that sometimes people don't introduce themselves, and or they do it in a way that you don't understand who they are or what their name is. So I think that that's a really important from that perspective also. And as far as responsibility for events that happen, I would think that it might be worth checking out how the risk management people define responsibility or others, whether it's just confined to your office or whether it includes the corridors or the connection between facilities if you're connected, because as a patient, you would still expect some responsibility, that there were some policies or something in place. That's all.
Thank you. I mean, it's a worthwhile thing to look into the issue of where does the responsibility end on the outpatient side. I don't really have a good sense of that for a practice as a standalone practice. So that might be something NQF could look into further.
Yeah, in a lot of instances, when you're looking at liability insurance, most of the time you are responsible for, you know, if somebody falls on the sidewalk out front. But if it's owned by somebody else, like if you're renting that space and it's owned by somebody else, then it's usually strictly from a liability standpoint, whoever owns the property itself.
Okay, good point.
Something to look into.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so we'll move to the new SRE submissions. How many of these are there, Lindsay? There are
11. There are 11. Two of them are very similar, and so it's almost like there are 10.
Okay. So the first one is patient death or disability as a consequence of MRI error, defined as magnetizable material inside the MRI room. So applicable to our setting?
Now, I would propose that that's a yes. Orthopedic surgeons have personal MRI machines in their offices. Some of them do. And then I'll also propose that if you have a radiologist and they practice independently, their small imaging center, which is their office, you know, that's the only place they practice, is a physician office. They're there. They're the doctor there. They do procedures. They do imaging. But I'll just propose that. But certainly orthopedic surgeons have MRI machines in their offices.
I would agree.
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 So this is Saul. I agree with the idea of, you know, in general, I think the term MRI error needs to some more clarity. And I'm not sure that we all need to figure that out, but...
it's an error in screening.
Well, they're talking about the magnetizable material inside the room, specifically.
Yeah, so it's not really directly related to the MRI itself. It almost makes it sound like if you're making an error when you're actually performing the MRI.
It's an error in screening what enters the room.
Right.
Right. So it could be as a consequence of MRI, an error in MRI pre-screening or something like that.
Well, I would just, rather than defining it as a process thing, I would make it more, you know, death or disability as a consequence of, you know, metal projectiles resulting in, you know, death or disability. I wouldn't, you know.
That's more clear.
I mean, even if it's, I mean, it might be that there's a, you know, some piece of equipment in the room that's not appropriately tied down.
So say that again, Saul, in terms of how you would word it.
Well, I would say, you know, death or disability is a consequence of metal projectiles.
In the MRI area or something?
MRI area.
Do we want to stay with the term magnetizable, which kind of is more broad?
I don't know, but I'm trying to think of a better word.
Stepping back for a sec, it may be, think of this as a sentinel event, it may be useful to kind of strike the language on death or disability and basically any patient harm or even just the presence of a You know, it seems like it's a little over-restrictive just to focus on people who are killed by these things.
That's a good point.
I mean, I don't know enough MRI technicians, but I think, you know, every so often a paperclip goes flying through the air.
Absolutely.
So I don't want to get all of those necessarily.
Well, if we say harm, would that make it a little, you know, if somebody gets, you know, hit in the leg and ends up with a bruise, the issue is still that there was something in the room that should have been removed or secured.
Yeah.
It was big enough. It, presumably, if it was a paperclip, presumably wouldn't result in harm.
Right.
Or eye or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so patient harm is a consequence of, and then I'm, all your language is sort of, you know, projectile objects in the MRI area. Something along those lines.
Right.
I might define it as injury rather than harm.
Okay, that's a good idea.
Okay. So if we go with that, then it would be discrete, auditable, and clearly defined, and preventable, yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Any other modifications besides what we've talked about?
No.
Okay. And entirely preventable?
Yes.
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 I don't know. I guess I would defer that to, like, people with more expertise, but I just don't know about if there are reasonable things in which screening might miss something that would, you know, not be blameworthy per se or problematic.
I think as long as you put the harm in, it's okay. You know, if you miss a hairpin and it comes out, or a little barrette and it comes out, that's unlikely to cause harm.
I think that would be good for NQF to review with a radiology group, but my sense is, from some of the work we've done, that it should be entirely preventable if you've got the right zones and screening and all that stuff.
Okay, good.
But it'd be good to clarify. Okay. So the next one is patient death or serious injury associated with prolonged fluoroscopy with cumulative dose greater than 1,500 rads to a single field, or any delivery of radiotherapy to the wrong body region, or 25% above or below the dose. So that's a lot in one sentence.
I think that the idea of doing something on radiology and radiation-related injuries is important and timely, but I'm not sure that the way this one is framed is gets to that exactly.
Well, first question is this relevant to our setting?
Again, physicians have fluoroscopy in their office.
Yes.
I think this should absolutely be a reportable event if they do this to someone.
I agree.
It's
I agree.
A specialty thing probably, maybe orthopedics, that kind of thing, but yes.
Absolutely.
Even a chest x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Plenty of doctors do chest x-ray.
Yeah, we have radiology in our office, and we're out in the middle of the boonies.
Okay, so it is relevant. So then
question
in terms
is
of
defined here.
The definition, it's very clearly defined, but it's just a lot.
Defer to a radiologist.
We need some more expertise on this one. I mean, that, you know, body tissues are, the sensitivity to radiation is highly variable by region and organ.
Right.
And so I don't know. I mean, I really like this, the idea of doing something in this area, especially given all the New York Times attention.
Right.
I think we need some additional input before we sign off on it.
And it might be something like patient death or serious injury associated with radiation exposure, and then
recommend
definition around that.
Yes.
I think that sounds good.
Right.
Because they do list some good references, it looks like.
Yeah, from a radiologist standpoint, these are very reasonable limits that they've put down that need to be reported.
Right. I guess there's a clarification issue, maybe that the question of delivery of radiotherapy to the wrong body region might benefit from some greater specificity, leading it to the radiologist to define exactly what that would be. The other question is whether we want to restrict it just to death or serious disability like the other thing, or whether this should be also thought about sentinel events, so any harm or injury that might even be less severe.
Well, or serious injury, you know, like we talked about previously, might not be apparent until much later. So high, you know, exposure to excessive radiation with increased risk of a malignancy later, you know, 10 years later.
Insert the word ionizing.